I think everyone probably knows by now that in April, we are electing a new mayor in Kansas City, Missouri. Did you know that we're also voting on school board positions, not just in Kansas City public schools, but in other districts too? Hickman Mills, Center, Raytown, Grandview, Lee Summit. Perhaps you are yawning and quietly willing me to stop listing school districts and uttering the words school board. But the thing is, these are important positions. Whenever we have conversations about public education on this show, people are very eager to weigh in. They're some of the most heated discussions we have. Well, voting in new school board officials is one way to make yourself heard. So before we're all staring down a ballot in April, let's educate ourselves on what a school board does and why it matters. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is School Boards 101 on KCUR's Central Standard. Let's start with a national guest. Chuck DeVerics has been studying education for the last 20 years, and he just published a study on school boards. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, big picture, what is the purpose of a school board? What functions does it perform?
Well, the school board is a local board or entity. It's typically elected, but sometimes appointed, that is the main focal point for public education in a community. The concept goes back even before the American Revolution, when some colonies set up schools and enlisted citizens to help run them. Today,
can you explain that, though? Like, what was the thinking there?
Well, I think it mostly went back to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, where there was a formal policy enacted that they wanted public education for children, and it would be on a local level, and that because it was on a local level, you needed some local people to help help oversee it and help make sure it was doing its job.
So, okay, you've mentioned that sometimes they are elected and sometimes they are appointed. What observations do you have about the differences between these two models?
Well, certainly elected public school boards are predominant today. That's probably been the case for about 30 to 40 years. The thought behind it is that it increases public interest in education and that you might be better at responding to the public's will. The public will know how to reach you. They may be your neighbor. You stand for election every 3 or 4 years. And the whole thought is that it would be someone who is more in touch with the community, building community support for education. There still are some appointed school boards. It may happen in jurisdictions where, for example, a state or a mayor's office may have taken over a low-performing school district. And in that case, the overseer may appoint people who are specific education experts, as opposed to those who are in the community, maybe not education practitioners, but very passionate about the subject.
So let's walk this back with me. The basic functions of the school board are?
Well, they approve budgets, which that's a major responsibility every year. They set school boundaries, which can be a very contentious issue in certain communities. They hire a superintendent, and that's really perhaps their most important responsibility. They want to find someone who matches their vision of what the school system should be. And then when they're not doing that, they really set all the major policies of a district related to curriculum and instruction. They set those policies, which are then carried out by teachers and administrators.
In this study, you write about the characteristics of the most effective school boards. What are those characteristics in your view?
Well, you know, there hasn't been a lot of research done on school boards, I think in part because it's a little hard to isolate. If you're an English teacher, you know how much your students have learned in a certain year. But with school boards, they set in motion policies that have implications both in the short term and the long term. So the research that I've looked at basically is examining districts that have similar demographics, what was different in the high-achieving districts, including the question of how they were governed. And there are kind of 8 basic characteristics, but I'd say the most important ones are that they set a vision of high expectations. And with that vision, they set clear goals that are related to them, and they monitor those goals on at least a yearly basis. They have shared beliefs and values that all students can learn and that schools can effectively serve students, and they're data savvy. And that also means looking at data even if it's negative. And when they look at data, they're not really doing it to engage in a blame game. They're doing it to look forward and how can they improve something. In lower achieving districts, if you interviews with school board members, a lot of them would blame poverty or lack of parent involvement. I think in the higher achieving districts, the board members see those as challenges to be overcome and not something to blame, not a blame game. And then finally, just that they hire a superintendent that supports their vision, and that they work with that superintendent. They all go through professional development. They learn about how to work effectively. There is an interest in finding a balance between being, say, just rubber stamping what a superintendent wants to do, that you don't want to do that, but you also don't want to be a micromanager. So it's finding that balance. And I think once they do that, I think school boards have the foundation for a successful term.
What are some of the ways that school boards can become ineffective? And specifically, I'm interested in how that affects families and education outcomes in those districts.
Well, and I think I've mentioned this a little earlier. I think the blame game is one that really can be a sign of a school board that's not working effectively. It's a case where it's not my fault. You're not necessarily taking ownership as a public official. You're looking at reasons why the school may not succeed. There's also the issue of whether the school board collectively can function effectively. What are the norms? What are the expectations and the practices across the board? I would say that one of the real signals that there could be a problem, which I have seen, is, for example, if a school board can't approve the minutes of its own meetings, if that's contentious, that is clearly a sign that things are not going quite as you expected.
Yeah, if you can't run a meeting, you can't run a school district.
Right, right. And there are certainly there can be disagreements about whether the superintendent is the right person at a particular time. That's one that plays out in a lot of different communities. And it's all about how the board approaches those issues and does it in a collegial way.
Are there variations on the politics around this from city to city? Or are you kind of seeing a certain story that plays out in cities all over the country right now?
Well, there's about 14,000 different school boards across the country. They serve about more than 50 million children. So it's hard to know from site to site. I think that traditionally school boards have generally been nonpartisan. There are states and communities where you may run by major party. Typically, you don't, though. And the belief behind that is that schools shouldn't be a Democrat or Republican issue. It's a community issue. You have seen some signs of that changing in a few states. I think in southern states, you're seeing that a little bit. Certainly, the Common Core standards that were enacted in many localities have generated a fair amount of criticism. So I think in some communities, you are seeing it be a lot more politicized than you might have maybe 5 or 10 years ago.
What are, we are a major metropolitan area with, I would say, roughly a gazillion school districts. Is that unusual?
No, it's not. As I said, it's 14,000 different school boards, and they can really run the gamut from a small board of maybe 3 members to a larger board of 9 members. It's typically an odd number of members, so you don't have a lot of tie votes. But it really depends on what the needs of the community are. The other issue is that you have board members in a large district may represent just a certain neighborhood. Maybe the district where they live is part, is one district, and there are maybe 3 or 4 districts within a school. A school system. So you're representing your neighborhood, but you also have to represent the best interests of your entire school system. And I think that's a challenge that often comes up for members as they're weighing various alternatives.
Well, hold on with me. I'm going to bring in KCUR's Ellie Moxley. She's our education reporter here, and I want to talk to her about school boards of Kansas City. Hi, Ellie.
Hey.
So before we dig in, anything you want to respond to or follow up on so far and what Chuck has explained about, like, big picture nationwide with school boards?
You know, one thing I do want to make sure that is understood here in Kansas City in particular is about half of our kids within the boundaries of Kansas City public schools attend charter schools. And charter schools are public schools. They are not traditional public schools in that sense, you know, the way we think of the district schools, but they are public schools and they do have boards. And those boards are not typically elected. They might be elected within the school community, but they are not elected by voters at large. So I think that is something that is relevant to this conversation, to, you know that we do have non-elected school boards here in the metro that govern public schools. In terms of the gazillion school districts we have, my best count for the number of schools and school districts I cover is like 46, I think. I haven't looked at it recently.
That is very close to a gazillion.
It's not far off. So this is one of the reasons that I always feel bad when people email me or ask me, hey, are you going to be at our meeting or are you going to be at this? And I'm like, I haven't figured out telelocation yet, but I promise I'm working on it.
Yeah.
So
we just have a really sprawling public education system.
Right.
Here.
So we have both the Kansas side school districts and the Missouri side school districts. We have all of the different charter schools. Within the city limits of Kansas City, there are 14 school districts.
Kansas City, Missouri.
And that's a little atypical. In most states and in other states where I have covered education, you tend to have a bigger central city school district than we have. KCPS is a pretty small district. It has right now around 15,000 students. It really stretches basically from around the river down to about 85th Street. And then we also have Center and we have Hickman Mills. And then we have all these different districts that pick up pieces of the metro, that are in, they're up in the Northland and they're parts of Kansas City and parts of North Kansas City and parts of, that's definitely a challenge, is that our school district boundaries in Kansas City do not necessarily follow our municipal lines. So you could have someone who, and I think this is very common, especially in like the Marlboro neighborhood in South Kansas City, where one side of the street is Kansas City Public Schools and one side of the street is Center School District. And as a result, your neighbors can be going to different schools and you could be voting on the same city council person, but you could be voting in a different school board sub-district.
It's very wild.
It's weird.
So you go to local school board meetings. What are they like? What happens at these meetings?
So I actually joke that the best way to know if a school board is like working the way it should be is if it's really, really boring. Like if you're at the meeting and they're going through the minutes and they're doing all the procedural things and they're having these kinds of like minute kind of conversations going back and forth. Like,
but what kinds of minute conversations?
Are we doing this in the right order? Are we, have we followed, our national guest was making the point that, good school boards have like a strategic plan and they have like kind of a vision in place and they're looking at that plan. And that's something you actually see a lot in school boards. You'll see like, okay, this is the individual line item that we're talking about in, say, a budget, but also, or this contract we're approving, but there's always usually a piece of discussion that's, how does this fit in with our goals? How does this fit into, what we want for the district long term?
So they're comparing line items in a budget to essentially line items in a strategic plan.
Yeah, and bigger ideas in a strategic plan. I think a good example of this was is last month I covered, it was a pretty big decision in Kansas City Public Schools to switch the bus contract from one company that has historically done the bus contract to another company. And one of the big discussions that they had in this was, in the past, they haven't had that many companies bid because the infrastructure in KCPS for providing busing wasn't great. There wasn't, you know, a central bus facility, a central transportation hub. And they have made over the last few years decisions like, we're going to acquire that hub, we're going to make that expenditure, we're going to do that. And as a result, they had several companies that they were able to pick from and weigh this time instead of just having one bus contract that they were considering. So it was one of those things where, you know, you'll see there's a lot of moving parts with school boards. And if things are being done well and, you know, the governance is good, it may not always be exciting in the audience, but, you know, you'll kind of start seeing how all the kind of gears start turning together in the machine to make the pieces work.
So you have a theory about the three types of people who seek out school board positions.
I have a highly unscientific theory about the three types of people. But I will say I've been running this theory by a bunch of school board members and school board candidates, and all of them have burst out laughing. So I think they can probably see themselves in one of these types. So the first type is just like the nerd, like the policy wonk, the person that is really into education. This is the point in the conversation where I'm usually like, if you really like spreadsheets, and that's usually when the laughter starts, like, because those people, they know which ones they are. So there's the education nerds over here. Then you get the climbers. And I don't think this is typical, and this is not necessarily a good or a bad. There's a lot of people who use school board as kind of the first foray into politics. Like, you made the point earlier that these are folks that they might only represent a neighborhood versus a larger piece of the community. It's a good way to get name recognition, to start kind of thinking about how you're going to make a mark on your community. That said, there's a lot of folks in that position who end up serving really well until they move on to the next thing. And it also gives them a better understanding of education issues if they do seek a higher office. And finally, there's the rabble-rouser. And this person can be kind of a wild card because you can both have the types that end up being somewhat disruptive because they have a particular agenda, and that's really the only reason they care about being on the school board. They have their one pet issue. But you also, I think you need a certain degree of the rabble-rouser in this space, because it is sometimes how the conversations about how what needs to change in education gets started.
So there are a couple of distinctions I want to make. First of all, the distinction between what the mayor is in charge of and what the school board is in charge of. And I ask that one largely because of this controversy around universal pre-K, and part of that tension boiling down in a sense to whether the mayor is going around the school boards here. And then, so there's the mayor versus school board. Then there's also the difference between what the superintendent does and what the school board does. I'd like you to just sort of clarify these roles in determining education policy.
You know, you have cities where a mayor has a more formal role in the governing of schools. I used to report in Indiana, and in Indianapolis, the mayor's office actually sponsors charter schools, for instance, and it has a different dynamic. There have been discussions in this metro area about, you know, when we talk about takeover of schools over, you know, state takeovers, mayoral takeovers, that kind of thing. As it is, the mayor's office and the school board, they're separate entities. And sometimes they work in harmony, and sometimes they end up butting heads. You know, you have both, and you have both examples. For example, one of the initiatives that I think Mayor Sly James has gotten a lot of credit for during his administration has been his emphasis on third grade reading, and, you know, this focus on getting more third graders reading at grade level. So he has a nonprofit organization, Turn the Page KC, that does work in the school district, and I think that's help that the schools are grateful for. At the same time, you know, then you have like this pre-K issue where the mayor's office is really pushing this 3/8 of a cent sales tax that will be on the ballot next month to get more 4-year-olds into pre-K, basically for families to be able to pay on a sliding scale to get their kids into pre-K. But the school districts, they don't like this plan. They really have some troubles with the governance, and they really have some issues with whether or not it's going to fit into the existing infrastructure for providing early childhood education.
And then the superintendent versus school board?
I had something that was summed up for me by a school board member that I think makes a lot of sense. The school district or the school board's responsibility is to hire the superintendent, but that's it. They don't hire anybody else. It's the superintendent on down that makes decisions about hiring teachers and principals and administrators. But they have to make sure that hire at the top is someone that they really trust to, you know, put that vision together.
So do you think school boards should matter to people whether they have kids or not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things is in Kansas City is we talk a lot about, you know, one of the things we need for a thriving community are thriving public schools. And I think that the conversation around education is changing in this city. I think that the district has made some significant strides in the last 5 years that I've been here in Kansas City, back in Kansas City. But at the same time, I also think that, you know, you should be invested.
I'm Gina Kaufman. In just a minute, we will bring a parent in on this discussion, and you can join us to call with any questions about what a school board is, what it does, why it matters. 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about school boards, what they do, why they matter. There are lots of school board positions being voted on in the upcoming municipal elections, so this is a good time to learn this stuff if you don't know it already. I've been chatting so far with KCUR's Ellie Moxley and researcher Chuck DeVerix. Hi again, you two.
Hey.
Hi.
Now let's turn to Lisa Gooden. She's a mother of three, and her kids are in Kansas City Public Schools. She's also on the board of the District Area Committee. Lisa, what does that mean?
The District Advisory Committee is a group of parents and community members, and our goal is to give the parent voice to both the board and the administration of the school district.
So we just heard why school boards should matter to Kansas Cityans who don't have kids. What do school boards and school board politics mean to you as a parent and a very engaged parent in particular?
So a school board election is important to me because it's a very local election. It can have a very big impact on our immediate community. Your elected members, like Chuck said, can live in your neighborhood or the surrounding areas. So it's much more likely that you might be able to speak to them. And if you choose to reach out and share your priorities, your concerns, there's the possibility that it may actually have an impact on their decisions.
So what do you think of when you think of like someone who is good at serving on a school board? What do you think those qualities are?
I would look for a candidate with stability and cooperation. I think it's very important to have a functional board, even if they have disagreements, that they can still work together.
So it's not looking for a particular position on an issue necessarily?
I certainly have my own issues that I'm concerned about, but I think the most important thing is to have a board that's representative of the community they're serving. You know, for Kansas City Public Schools, the majority of students are students of color, so having leaders of color on the board is important. And I think having different opinions on the board is a good thing. Again, as long as they can work together to provide, you know, the guidance that we need for the public schools in Kansas City, I think that's the most important thing.
Can you give me an example of, you know, you mentioned you have your own issues you care about. Can you give an example of one where the way that someone on the school board is going to see this issue is something that's going to translate to a matter of significance in your life, in your kids' lives, and educational outcomes as you see it?
I would like the board to look at education as a whole in Kansas City. Like Ellie mentioned, we have a lot of students in the district, but we have a lot of students in charter schools. We also have a lot of students in private schools. And I think that our board needs to be leaders in the Kansas City education community as a whole. So I would like them to look at how we can best educate all our students. We have a lot of school choice, and I think we can be doing more to evaluate enrollment and retention of low-income students in those schools of choice. Currently, they're underrepresented in a lot of those schools. And to be really more equitable in our education, we need to, you know, put some policies in place to make sure we're serving all students equitably.
So as someone who is a parent, not coming to this from a background of like you've been like focused on education policy, like has there been a learning curve for you in terms of what school boards do, how they do it, how to navigate it?
Our district advisory committee has been able to speak with board members directly and the superintendent and share our thoughts and priorities. Ellie described was correct. Like the board sets policies and overall governance, but does not micromanage. The superintendent and his administration is who puts those procedures into place. And so from a parent's perspective, learning how to navigate the differences between communicating with the board about our priorities or communicating with the administration to actually get things done, sometimes
within a particular school
or between the whole district, if there's a lot of centralized administrators too.
Interesting. So earlier, our other guest, Chuck, shared his research on what makes some school boards effective and others not. But he shared some of the characteristics that effective school boards tend to share. How does the Kansas City Public School Board measure up in as far as what you've witnessed?
I think the recent board has been very stable, and I think our schools have benefited from that. The last 2 out of 3 years, we've earned enough points to be fully accredited range from the state, and I think having a strong leadership and stability has really helped that.
Well, I'm curious, Chuck, listening to all of this, listening to both Ellie's descriptions of how this plays out in Kansas City, how school boards play out, as well as listening to a parent describe her experience, what are you hearing?
Well, I'm certainly interested in the three types of school board members that Ellie was talking about, in terms of nerd in education, the climbers and the rabble-rouser. I think there is a certain amount of truth to that. I do think that school boards need to be responsive to their communities, and people need to vote for school boards, even if they're not, if their kids have aged out of the school system. It's something that fundamentally affects your community. The business community looks toward school systems, whether or not it's worthy of expanding jobs or bringing in new jobs. And I think that it's just fundamental to a functioning community to have an effective school board. I know the charter schools are a major issue in the Kansas City area, and they look a lot different. Charter school laws look so much different from in states and cities. You may go through situations where a school board has to approve a charter school. And I think that is often an eye-opener because the school board members have to be open to various solutions, and I think that is one of the keys. It's finding the solutions that work best for those families in that district and that can raise achievement.
Ellie, I'd like you to jump back in just to talk about the upcoming election a little bit. There is an open position that no one's even running for. How do you explain that?
Well, there's a position that no one has filed for. That doesn't mean that there aren't write-in candidates running. And in fact, this is Subdistrict 4. It covers parts of Midtown, and it stretches across the east side all the way to the sports complex. And there are actually 4 candidates that have stepped up since, the filing date and thrown their names in the hat. It's Clinton Adams, Marvia Jones, DeMonte Rochester, and Ibrahim Ramsey. And they're all running they're running campaigns. They're showing up at all the school board forums. They're, circulating their campaign materials. They're getting out there and talking about the issues. They're all very responsive and, were quick to tell me, yes, I want to participate. I just did candidate profiles for all the KCPS candidates. And, so that is true. There are a couple of races that you're not going to actually see on the ballot. It's the 2 at-large seats. The 2-year term is going to go to Patty Manser, who's an incumbent, and the other one, the 4-year term is going to go to Jennifer Wolfsey, another incumbent. And then the 2nd and 3rd districts, which represent the northern part of the city, they've already been decided because only one person filed to run in those races. And the way it works, at least with school board subdistrict elections, is if only one person files, the seat automatically goes to them. So you may not see a school board race on your ballot in Kansas City if you're voting, and it's because that race has already been decided in your sub-district.
Are there any thoughts about just if people coming out of this conversation, if they came into it knowing nothing about what a school board does and they come out of it getting one thing, what's the one thing that you just think you have to get this?
You may be attracted to a particular candidate that's running for school board because of their position on an issue. And I think that's important because that's how a lot of these people build rapport with the communities that they serve. But at the same time, the biggest function of a school board is to do these governing tasks, hire superintendents, set budgets, approve contracts, these big picture things in a school district, make visions for the district. And, you know, so you need to accept that whoever you vote for, whatever their platform is, that may not end up being the biggest issue on the school board and being the thing that, you know, really ends up mattering.
Well, Ellie Moxley, Lisa Gooden, Chuck Tavarics, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been School Boards 101 on KCUR's Central Standard. Up next, School of Rock. We're talking about pop music as literature with a couple of music critics. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm joined by two well-known, longtime Kansas City music critics who have teamed up to teach a class at Johnson County Community College. It's called Literature of American Pop Music, and I won't lie, when I read about the class, I wished I could take it. So here we are, all of us getting a taste of this class together on the radio right now. Danny Alexander, David Cantwell, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Let's just very quickly give each of our listeners a sense of your own musical journeys as critics and as listeners of music. This is Danny Alexander.
I started writing about music about the same time I started teaching, so these things are very parallel. But music gave me an identity when I was a teenager and really liberated me from maybe the kid I was before. And so I didn't know what to do with that. Thought I might be a musician at one point. And but eventually figured out that my role was to write about it, respond to it, you know, and I've been doing that for 33 years, maybe. Yeah, it's a long time.
David?
That's kind of my story, too. Danny's down in Oklahoma growing up, and I was in Ruskin Heights, South Kansas City, here in town, and but, you know, working class. And about the time I started to teach in the middle 80s at the University of Missouri Columbia, I found the work of a particular critic named Dave Marsh. And I know he's very important to Danny as well. And he was the first critic that I'd encountered that sort of wrote about the music from a class perspective, really focused on the working class, that rock and roll was a music that was speaking for those who normally didn't get a voice. And so I really responded to that.
Well, let's start playing music and talking about it. The first song needs no introduction, so I'm not going to introduce it. This is, of course, Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen.
I thought you weren't going to introduce it.
Well, that is a back-announce. Excuse me.
Very good.
We like back-announcing. That's good.
How do you teach this song in your literature class?
Well, one of the things that I try to focus on when I teach the class is that we're focused on close listening. So that means you're listening to not just the words, but to the performance and the arrangement, the setting of those words. And then we're listening within a context, which goes beyond the record and out into the political world. And one of the things that's amazing to me about Born in the USA is how it's a really good example of how records may be made to express one meaning, and then once they get out into the world, other people use them for other meanings. And so it's a record that was clearly critical of the United States. And yet it was embraced in 1984 during that patriotic Reagan-era moment by Reagan, by the columnist George Wills. It was a sort of used as like a rock version of the country hit from that same year, God Bless the USA, by Lee Greenwood. But it could not be a song that's more different. And so I think, as Danny was mentioning to me before we came in here, it's like, Bruce has kind of spent the rest of his life coming up with new versions of performing that song so that you get the point that he's that it's about being born down in a dead man's town and taking kicks, not about American pride.
Yeah, it's a brutal lyric. And I remember it's funny because it got taken on as such an anthem. And of course, it lends itself to that because it's got it's. I didn't think it was catchy when I first heard it, but it catches people. But I remember thinking it was like so raw and like nothing he'd ever done before. And like, it was like Nebraska with a band and it was a huge, scary sound.
It's enervating.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't dance to it necessarily.
Yeah.
I would dance to it, but with like fist pumps.
Yeah, well, exactly. I have fist pumps written here in my notes. It's not a dance song. It's a sway and a fist pump and a sing along.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so we're switching gears a little bit.
We're switching gears.
Bob Dylan won a Nobel Prize for Literature, and that was controversial. And so I want to play a little bit of Bob Dylan, because with Bruce Springsteen, it's about a story. So this is like the novel or short story aspect of literature. Bob Dylan is more the poetry and like the creating a mood or abstract idea. And so we're going to listen to this a little bit because this is a different kind of literature. And I've picked this song, Visions of Johanna, because the opening line is one of my favorite lines in anything anywhere. And I totally consider it poetry.
Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? We sit here stranded, we're all doing our best to deny it. And Louise holds a handful of rain, tempting you to defy it.
Danny, I don't know who Louise is. I don't know who Johanna is, but I feel something from this song.
Well, I mean, the poetry is no doubt there, and that's Dylan is known for like lending a poetic sensibility, an overt one, like that comes from the beat writers or whatever into popular music. But what I hear when I hear Dylan is a voice you don't normally hear, and I hear a poignancy to the music that a plaintive quality to the music that. You know, I don't even have to know what he's saying, even though he's known for his words.
I hear American individualism and the flip side of that, which can be isolation.
Sure.
But that's in the voice, the texture of Dylan's voice and his phrasing, and not the words, which are often poetic but are not poetry. I would argue they're he's a songwriter. And that's what I liked. That's why I loved the fact that he won the Nobel, is because it allowed into the world of literature songs, songcraft, composition, as opposed to just prose and rhyme on a page.
So you guys have mentioned to us that you have been listening to a lot of Tracy Chapman this semester.
Oh, my class.
So in thinking about her from a literary standpoint, we've pulled the song Fast Car. Let's give it a little listen for those who aren't so familiar.
Okay.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove.
to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Just across the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living.
Can you talk to me about what the car symbolizes in this song and just broadly in the literature of American pop music?
Escape and aspiration, for a better life. You know, I mean, they're explicitly trapped from the beginning of the song. They end up, this is like a classic, I think like in a country ballad, there's sort of verse to verse, you have, they end up in a shelter. And then she ends up confronting him about the fact that the car didn't take them anywhere. And maybe he should take it. Or I don't know if it's a he. But you know, you have that a constant theme in rock and roll is the busting out of your traps. Cars almost always symbolize that and trying to go somewhere that's better. The flip side of that is the coming home song, you know, which in some ways this song has all of that. I think one of the things that's so powerful about Fast Car is how compressed it is and how simple it is. There's so much there.
Okay, I've brought in another car song. This one's maybe from about the same era, but the car represents, at least on the face of it, something pretty different, at least a different mood. This is Prince with Little Red Corvette. It's not surprising that cars figure prominently in our music.
Oh, no. All the way back to Something Else by Eddie Cochran and all kinds of 1950s rock and roll songs were all about, so it's the guys who have the car sometimes get the girl. In this song, I think it's the other way around. It's a Prince song, so the Little Red Corvette is going to symbolize either sex or God. I'm going to go with sex here. And it's sex that maybe is out of his reach, which is something that happens a lot. I was hearing it in my head in conversation with Scrubs. You know, the TLC song where they're hanging out the side of your best friend's ride. A guy who doesn't have a car trying to get with someone who does. And or failing.
That's sort of like along the same lines of get out of my dreams and into my car.
Mm-hmm. Well, and sexual liberation's a huge part of what rock and roll from the beginning has been about. So,
you know, okay.
It gets its name from sexual liberation.
This is not totally off topic here, but we're going to turn to country music and sort of a recurring story in country music, which is the story of people leaving a country or small town and heading for the city. And so I also want to have two sides of that coin to talk about, sort of in the context. We're not going to play this song right now because we're running low on time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Kacey Musgraves won the Grammy for Best Album this year, and that was controversial. But you make the case that the story Kacey Musgraves is telling is not one that is a departure in country music, but one that is part and parcel of that story.
Yeah, I think, David, do you have something to say to this? Because it seems like...
To Musgraves specifically, or
yeah,
to Merry-Go-Round? By,
yeah.
Or, so the Musgraves is definitely... on the album, well, you brought up the album that album she won the award for. And that's kind of, not her typical work. It's not like a lot of her early singles had been. It's much more of a kind of, I don't want to use the word escapist. I think people, it's more like a redirection. It's this beautiful pop country mood that she creates, songs about love, songs about noticing the important things, songs about gratitude, songs about taking a breath. And it really, I think Golden Hour, the album we're talking about, is really going to go down as one of the Trump era albums. It never mentions him. It doesn't touch upon any of those categories. It's almost like a redirection back to what matters.
I guess my question is that what is the recurring theme that you hear in Kacey Musgraves' album that also is just like a theme of country music in America?
Well, of the Golden Hour album, if that's what you're talking about, it's love. I mean, that it's romantic domestic partnership. I mean, that's the grown up part. Country music has always been considered a grown up music, and that's what that album is about. It's not as directly, I think, thematically, lyrically, musically, that's not as bound to country tradition as some of her earlier work was.
In terms of merry-go-round, I think, you know, we heard in the opening line of Born the USA, born down a dead man's town. I mean, it's a description of a dead man's town, but it's not without affection for the people who live there and who are this is who she is. This is, she's of
yeah.
them.
Yeah. Okay. Golden Hour doesn't touch upon it, but merry-go-round definitely is sort of pushing back on the sort of bro country idea of country. The small town is the real America, and in a lot of her early work especially, she pushed back on that idea and suggested that maybe the small town is a trap.
So now we're back to the small town. We have this recurring story of people leaving small towns, heading for the city. Let's hear the John Denver version of that story.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze. Country roads, take me home.
So John Denver just wants to go home. Like, we aren't going to have time to play it, but I was thinking about, next to John Denver, just Country Roads, Take Me Home. If you think about a song like Frank Sinatra's New York, New York, it is the opposite of that song, but it's the same story.
The Country Roads, the John Denver version we're listening to, it's poignant and it's heartfelt and it's reaching back for something, but you don't get the sense that he's actually getting in his car and going. Right, it's very much a wish of something that's been lost, something maybe he's grieving over, missing. But it's his future is probably in the city.
One of my students wrote this semester, "That's the countryest country song I've ever heard," and I think that's, you know, the very first country record or hillbilly record was "Little Old Cabin in the Lane."
Yeah, "Little Old Cabin in the Lane."
And the first great American hit I think was "Old Folks at Home," and they're all about the past and the home and what's been left behind, you know, in some way. Fair?
Listening, I mean, if you listen to all of John Denver's songs, I did find myself at one point being like, did no one ever just say like, hey man, just go home, it's cool. Like,
back
go.
Home again.
Go.
Yeah.
You had a nice place in Aspen.
Well, you all, your class sounds like so much fun. Any parting words for people as they maybe re-listen to some of their own favorite songs as literature?
I think it's important to remember that when we say music's literature, we're also talking about it as music and the notes and the sounds, the rhythms, the melodies. Those are part of the literature as well. And we really think there's a lot to be gained from being more conscious and aware of what role it plays in your life.
Sometimes when we value literature, we tend to focus on the stuff that's dark or the stuff that's challenging or deals with sadness and take that to be more serious. And one of the things we focus on in our class is that it's not. The fun stuff is,
We gotta go. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
You can listen back to everything at kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, tune in for a discussion about urban forestation, a fancy term for planting trees. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.